G'day everyone, welcome to episode 8 of The Ferret's Den. It's been a long time in the making, this one, since our last episode, and also trying to track down today's guests, obviously being in different time zones and a trip out to Australia. Dr. Emmeline Hill is an equine Irish geneticist and horsewoman who has dedicated her career to understanding the genetics behind the thoroughbreds. An early fascination with genetics led her to study human genetics and cattle genetics during her PhD. However, time and time again, she found herself drawn back to horses and the thoroughbred industry at large. With the advent of the new molecular tools and the sequencing of the human genome, Dr. Hill came to realize that she could apply these tools to study the horse genome. In 2009, she discovered the speed gene, a powerful biomarker that has revolutionized the equine genomics and greatly contributed to thoroughbred genetic research, and more recently has published uncovering genetic risk factors including recurrent laryngeal neuropathy in thoroughbreds. Katrina, we're very excited for this episode. I know you're a big admirer of Dr. Emmeline Hill's work.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Absolutely. You know, throughout my master's, I was referencing Dr. Emmeline Hill's work, and then starting to at working for Kieran, you know, we've been using the speed gene for, well, since I started really, so 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, incredible to have her on the show and to you know, really dig down in the world of genetics and really understand the how and the why. And I think a lot of people find it interesting. It's all well and good to say that your horse is a particular, you know, gene type, but actually understanding how that test was developed and how to apply it and sort of the overall use of genetics. And yeah, it's fascinating, and I think you'll really enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, every time we talk or meet up with Emmeline, I can see Kat's eyes light up, and no doubt mine do too. It's such a great conversation that we have with her. She's done some great work over the years. If there's any other nerds out there, always be sure to get on ResearchGate and type in Dr. Emmeline Hill, because you'd be amazed at how much research that she's just been involved with and actually published as well. There's some really fascinating stuff across all sorts of industries, like we said, the cattle, thoroughbreds, and human research in terms of the genetics. At Kiramar Racing, we've been using, obviously, the gene test for over sort of 4 years to 5 years now. They're, you know, an integral part of the process. They're ubiquitous in terms of their use from day-to-day racing decisions. Our assistant trainers and our training staff use them all the time, along with our racing managers, when I'm on the making decisions about where horses will be heading. So they're always front of mind, and now paired with our large data set, we can really unlock some interesting insights there, and even possibly doing some work down the line with Emmeline herself, hopefully in the future, that we can hopefully further this great research that she's doing in the space. So without further ado, let's get stuck into the episode.
Emmeline, thank you so much for joining us. I know from my own perspective, doing a research master's, I remember referencing so much of your work, and, you know, it's a real thrill to have you on here. You've done some incredible work, and, I mean, it must be every scientist sort of goal and dream to research something that you're passionate about and then develop something that can be practically used. And, you know, we've at Kiramar Racing, we've been using your speed gene test now for the past 5 years, and just really excited to dig into, you know, how that all started and, you know, the future of genetics in racing. So thank you for coming on the Ferret's Den.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
So I suppose we'll just jump right in. The speed gene test, can you just explain that to our listeners? I know it's sort of something that gets mentioned within the realms of training, and a lot of our owners will have received a speed gene test on one of their mini horses, but can you just give us an overview and an insight and just try and explain exactly what a speed gene test is, how it was developed, and yeah, how it's used?
Sure. So the speed gene test is the single most accurate genetic predictor of distance for thoroughbred horses, and it can be used to place horses in the most suitable races for their genetic potential. And it can also help trainers to manage their horses in a way that's maximizing the genetic potential of their horse. And so what it is it's a gene called myostatin that we test for. And myostatin is involved in the development of the muscle. So it's involved in the growth of muscle, which is known as muscle hypertrophy. And it's also involved in the differentiation of the different muscle fiber types. So what we do from a sort of a testing perspective, when we test for the speed gene in a horse, we're reading the DNA code of the myostatin gene in that horse. And we're looking at the specific spelling of the letters for that gene. And that can differ between horses. So what we've identified is that there are three different types of horse. A horse can be a CC type, a CT type, or a TT type. And that's the actual spelling of the myostatin genetic code. What we found in our research, and I started researching thoroughbred genetics over 20 years ago. And this was one of the first things that really jumped out because it was so big. It was such a strong indicator for us. When we did our original research, and this has panned out over the last 15 years since we made the first discovery, is that the CC horses are best suited to sprint racing. The CT horses are best suited to middle distance racing, and the TT horses are better suited to longer distance, more stamina oriented racing. And that is because the CC horses tend to, what the gene does in CC horses is that it enables the muscle to more rapidly develop at a younger age and respond to the early training stimulus in a way that they're muscling up more quickly. So they're more precocious. They're maturing earlier than the CT and the TT types. So they can perform better as two-year-olds, or they tend to perform better as two-year-olds and start out earlier than the other types. The CC horses also have a higher proportion of type 2 fast glycolytic muscle fiber types. So these are the fiber types that are required for short bursts of speed. And that's the reason then that those CC horses are better suited at sprinting, because it's that muscle type that's required for sprinting. So there's a real underlying biological functional reason why the CCs are better suited to sprinting and the TTs are better suited to longer distance racing, because they have more of the aerobic type 1 or slow muscle fiber types, which is better suited for more longer distance type of racing. And then you have the CTs in the middle that have they're in between, they have a mix of both. So they tend to race over the middle distance range. So we now know the real biological reason for horses of these three different types being better suited to the three different distances. Now, of course, there's not just three distances in racing. I mean, we're very broadly putting them into sprinting, middle and longer distance categories. But it's played out, and I think we've tested at this stage, at least along with, we've tested tens of thousands of horses at this point. But when we've done our scientific studies and matched those speed gene types against the actual distances that the horses had won their best race over, we've done that in over 3,000 or 4,000 horses. And there's a very clear pattern that is consistent, and it's consistent across different regions. So we developed it in mostly with European horses, but we see exactly the same pattern in Australia. We see exactly the same pattern in North America, in Japan, in South Africa. The only difference across the regions is that there are slight differences in the race pattern. So Australia might tend to have more shorter distance races or more races in the shorter distances than in Europe. So there's slightly different patterns, but it tends to follow the same organization, and the CC's short sprint, CT's middle, and TT's long.
Yeah, and I mean, There's a lot to take in there. I know there are a few questions that we get asked all the time from owners, but Josh, you might have a few insights from our horses in what we've seen, because we've seen the exact same scenario with our CC, CTs and TTs with distance and the performance and getting to the track at, you know, a certain time.
We've got such a big build-up, like Kat says now, of collection of these gene tests that we've done retrospectively, combined that with our great training database, which there's actually some insights there we can touch on later. But the racing results really speak for themselves. They're, like you said, Emmeline, that the horses are running their best performance figure over what their sort of gene type says, and looking at it that, you know, our CCs are winning their best, you know, over sort of 1 in 5, 1 in 4, compared to, you know, going out in trip, but they're just not being as effective over ground. So we are trying them over ground, which is sometimes up to the trainer, and that's how we use the product at the end of the day. And sometimes, you know, horses are limited at sort of those sprinting trips, and that's just the way of the world, and that's how we use it in combination maybe with our training data. But it is a great predictor. It's linear in terms of that prediction that we've seen in the actual data, so we can definitely vouch for it. Is there any ways that you've seen along the way, this is probably a little bit different, is sort of, you know, along the way, have you seen any other clients sort of use it differently? How do your clients use it sort of in the UK? Is it same for that racing, you know, the racing placement side of things, or more so the training side of things, or if there's been any different sort of ways that people have started to use the product that you haven't foreseen when you created the product initially?
Yeah, well, it's definitely evolved over time as people have use it in their own hands, because you see the pattern, you know, that you see in your system, and everybody has different systems. So some people use it when they're, you know, when they just have yearlings in, and they're trying to figure out if they're going to be early types or later types. And they might do something different with them. So they might start the two-year-olds off and have them, you know, riding and, habituated to the training environment. But certainly for the TT horses, they would know to take them a bit more slowly and not push them at an early stage. So they might, have them backed and riding, and then give them a rest before bringing them in to actually putting them into full training and starting work with them. So from a very early stage, we're seeing it's not just about race placing for the horses. It's about managing them from an early age. And that gives them the best opportunity, particularly, you know, when you consider, you know, the potential for injury risk. If you are, you know, training a horse in a particular way that may not be suited to it, then, you know, you could be potentially putting it at a in a situation that could be increasing risk. So we do see trainers using it in that way from a you know, at a very early stage, and the value of that is that you know, I think for a long time people would have relied on pedigrees and looking at the pedigree to say, well, you know, this is what the dam and the sire, what it says, you know, on the pedigree page, the dam and the sire were this, or the trainer might say, well, I had the full brother in here last year and he was a, you know, an early two-year-old type, so I'll train this horse in the same way. Obviously the trainers are looking at the physical type of the horse as well, and they're putting all of these, you know, things together. No trainer is relying on just one excuse me, one single data point. They are, you know, looking at everything in the round. So adding this in is helpful. And from a pedigree perspective, the pedigree can't always tell you what that horse's genetic type is likely to be, because if you have two CT parents, then the progeny of two CT parents, if the sire is a CT and the dam is a CT, then that mating can actually produce all of the three different types. So if the mare passes on her C and the stallion passes on his C, you can get a CC. If one of them passes on the C and the other one passes on the T, then the foal could be a CT type. If one passes on, if they both pass on the T, then the foal can be the TT type. So what I'm saying is that you can have full siblings that can have exactly the same pedigree page, but genetically can be very different. So this is where trainers are really seeing the value of it from an early stage. So they're not making assumptions about the horse on the basis of what it looks like on its pedigree.
Well, you've answered the question that I was going to ask, because that's the one thing that, you know, we often have trouble because, you know, that traditionally is the way that it has always been done. And there is, you know, proof over time that a lot of the time, you know, the offspring will have attributes of their dam and sire, but it's those unique sort of cases where you have the dam and sire who have both won over 2,000, they're both CTs, and then, you know, you have to train the foal completely differently because they fall into those two other categories. So I know that we've found a lot of insight over the years with that, and, you know, the trainers really back the gene test. It's brought up all the time in race planning, and then also just using it with other data metrics that we take as well. It's amazing how often, you know, through the equimetric trackers or the lactates on the treadmill, that you'll find that there are those subtle differences between the different genetic types as well. So, you know, from a breeding perspective, if you are a breeder, how can you use that sort of gene and sort of makeup of your dam or your sire to sort of leverage the, you know, the information that you have on your horse and sort of, yeah, what can breeders be doing to try and be more accurate with producing the offspring that they want?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because we have a lot of people that use this in the breeding environment. So it's not just for training and racing, whereby breeders would have their mares tested for the speed gene type and then try to match their mares to a stallion that is most suited to the type of foal that they want to produce. So if a breeder is trying to produce more early precocious type horses, which are the CC types, then identifying stallions that are likely to produce more of the CC types for their mares is going to be beneficial, because they will be more consistently produce that type of foal. A lot of the stallions in Australia have their speed gene types. They've been tested for their speed gene types. Some stallion farms advertise that the genetic results. But even if they don't advertise the genetic results, they're willing to share the results with breeders if they're asked privately. So that can be really, really beneficial. In the sales, so just thinking about the value of it, we did a blind study of horses at yearling sales. This is some years ago, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, and we found that there was a very clear pattern in terms of the value that horses received in the sales ring with their genetic type. So the CCs were earning more than the CTs, and the CTs were earning more than the TTs in the sales ring. And that's because, as I mentioned in the beginning, about the muscling, what the gene actually does to the muscle is that those yearlings look more like, you know, young racehorses already at the early stage, even with the yearling prep work. They respond better to that stimulus, the exercise stimulus, so that they look more like their early types, and that they're earning more. So we did a study of that where we tested, I think, nearly 600 yearlings up the sales, and showed a very clear pattern. We also actually did a similar study at the sales in North America, and showed exactly the same thing. So from a breeding perspective, if you're breeding for it depends if you're breeding for the sales ring, if you're breeding for the race course and what your goal is, what your breeding goal is. But regardless of what the breeding goal is, the genetic test for your mare can help you to match that mare against a stallion to more consistently produce the type of foal that you want to produce.
Yeah, because I mean, in Australia, you know, it's a very sprint heavy racing style, the way the racing calendar is set up. And, you know, if you've got a well-bred 2-year-old colt, ideally you want him to win a big race over a sprinting trip as a 2-year-old. So that's what, you know, our trainers and owners, that's what they're looking to buy. If you're interested in that sort of, you know, area of the racing. And from our perspective, I know that when we find out a horse is a TT, it's sort of like, you know, their time, they don't really necessarily suit our racing pattern or the races that are available to our horses or for significant money. So we are always trying to sort of avoid that gene type. So if you've got breeders that are then also doing their best to avoid breeding TTs, is there the potential that we sort of breed out the TTs and we breed out the attributes that, you know, there are desirable attributes from that sort of gene population, and we sort of start to reduce the gene pool even more? From your perspective and what you know, like, how damaging is that? And yeah, and even the CTs, I suppose that even reduces the number of CTs, but yeah, just from your insight there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Kat. In Australia, the number of TTs is much lower than in other regions of the world. And that reflects the race pattern in Australia, as you've just described, where there are more opportunities for TTs in Europe, where the higher value races are the middle distance, long distance races, or the middle distance races in any case. So we do see that the number of TTs is lower in Australia. In fact, the number of TTs has halved in Europe, at least in Great Britain and Ireland, over the last 10 years. And that's because of breeders really targeting the sales ring rather than the race course. So the problem with what can happen there is that you can get a reduction in the gene pool. I suppose, and a slightly different topic, what this can lead to is an increase in what's known as inbreeding in the population, where you have a reduction in the genetic variation in the population. And that may not necessarily be driven by reducing TTs necessarily or specifically, but could be just because of the focus on particular sire lines that are bringing speed to the population. And when you reduce down the sire lines in the population, then that can increase inbreeding or reduce down the gene pool. And the first studies on this, looking at inbreeding in the thoroughbred, were published over 10 years ago by a group in North America, in Kentucky, where they showed that inbreeding in the genetic inbreeding in the population was increasing over time. We followed this on and published a paper about 5 years ago where we increased the sample size to thousands of horses from all different racing regions, including in Australia, and showed that inbreeding in the population of thoroughbreds is increasing. Now, some people said, well, that's to be expected. When you have a closed breeding population, you'd expect inbreeding to increase. Also, it was put to me, well, you know, inbreeding is good because what we're trying to do is we're trying to double up on the good genes. And so that's got to be a good thing because you're concentrating the good genes. But in actual fact, that's not the case. The science doesn't prove that out. In our own research and research that's done at the University of Sydney by researchers there, has shown that actually inbreeding is not good for the population and is not good for an individual. And the reason for this is that as well as inbreeding concentrating the good genes, it can disproportionately increase harmful genetic mutations in the population and in an individual. And so we followed on our studies on inbreeding to ask, okay, well, what is the problem with inbreeding? Is there a problem with inbreeding? And we found that horses that have higher inbreeding levels, and this is, I should distinguish, this is measuring inbreeding from the DNA level. So how much of the DNA that an individual has been identically inherited from the sire and the dam. That's what we refer to as inbreeding. So how much double copy DNA does a horse have? And when we did this, we found that horses with more double copy DNA or higher inbreeding have a lower chance of ever making a race course start. And that tells us that there's something going on that in larger amount of double copy DNA could be bringing along with it harmful mutations that are making those individuals less robust or less, I suppose, less viable for racing. So minimizing inbreeding in the population and reducing inbreeding in a single mating is likely to improve the chance of a foal that is born to actually ever start racing in the first place. And then following on from that, just last year, another study that was done by researchers in the UK collaborating with farms in Newmarket found that inbreeding in a mating was significantly associated with a higher rate of pregnancy loss. So if you have a stallion and a mare that are too genetically close to one another, they're likely to produce an embryo that has high inbreeding, and that's not viable for a pregnancy. Specifically, they looked at mid to late term pregnancy loss and found that when they took DNA samples from the tissues of those foals that didn't survive, those foals had higher levels of inbreeding than foals on the ground in the same farms that were born healthy and well. So yes, I suppose to go back to your question, reducing the gene pool in any population isn't great. It can lead to inbreeding, and inbreeding can be a problem. I mean, we see this in other species, and it's not just in the thoroughbred. I mean, in cattle, increasing inbreeding reduces fertility rates, can impact on production traits. Inbreeding in dogs can lead to all sorts of health issues. So it's not unique to the thoroughbred at all. But what we've done in our research is we've been able to identify where the problems lie. And the main thing now actually is that we've come up with a solution to help breeders with this.
It's a no-brainer and very logical, but I know we are trying to breed, from this such small population of these great stallions and these great lines. But at the end of the day, it's going to be detrimental to the thoroughbred population. Like you say, you're going to, the amount of disorders coming out, who knows what it's doing to the likes of the injuries of, you know, musculoskeletal injuries and soft tissue injuries where they're more susceptible, these horses. So we do see it in our own stable ourselves, and we wonder how many of those times. And I think you talked about some of the disorders, and we know that you've got, and we've used it a little bit, the RLN product that you have, so the recurrent laryngeal neuropathy, aka RORAs. Did you want to just touch on what that looks at? Obviously that's got a large correlation with what you just talked about then, Emily.
Yeah, so we've just earlier this year, we published a paper it was a research paper that we've been working on, or a study we've been working on for the last more than 10 years. This collaboration with a colleague of mine in University College Dublin in Ireland, Professor Lisa Katz. And Lisa and her veterinary students followed a cohort of horses for their first during their 2-year-old and 3-year-old season, and scoped them at various stages using the overground scope or exercising scope to look at the function of the throat and to classify horses as whether they are roarers or not. So RLN, or recurrent laryngeal neuropathy, is also known as roaring or laryngeal hemiplegia. It has different terms in different parts of the world. And we were able then, once we had DNA samples from these horses, so horses that were classified as having the disease and horses that were controls and didn't develop the disease during that time in the racing environment, we were able to identify genes that were different between the two groups, between the disease horses and the non. So that's really important from, first of all, from understanding the biology of what might be going on. These genes are involved in the development of neurons, and RLN is a neuropathy. So, but from a practical perspective, we would like to be able to, you know, we had a first go at developing a genetic test for RLN. And what we'd like to do is to try to improve it by validating the genetic markers that we've identified in our sample set against horses that in an entirely different sample set that have also have the disease or not have the disease. So collaboration from an industry perspective, if that is something that people want, if it's going to be useful and of value to people to know at an early age that a horse is likely to develop RLN, then that is something that we could continue to work on to develop a test like that. And I think for something like RLN, it is important to consider that it's a progressive disease. So at the sales, as you know, vets are scoping all of the yearlings to see how they are in their wind. But at yearling sales, at rest, the correlation between resting scopes and actually the development of the disease in the longer term isn't very good. There's not a strong correlation between resting scopes and the development of the disease. So actually having a genetic test at an early stage could actually help with predicting whether that is likely to progress, and this can be beneficial for the horse in particular, because the earlier you can take intervention steps, the better the outcome for that individual animal.
Yeah, I mean, we see, you know, certain stallions, I think, that have, we see it and we think that horse seems to throw bad breathers or roarers more frequently than another stallion. Would you, so that is supporting the fact that it is sort of a genetic based disease?
Yeah, it's definitely a genetic based disease. So in our studies, we can measure how much genetics contributes to a particular trait. It's a measure called heritability. So for any trait, we can measure how much genetics is influencing the outcome for the trait. And for roaring, it's about 40%. So that means that 40%, so the genetics is contributing about 40% to that outcome.
Oh, so that's quite significant. Yeah. And like sort of furthering that sort of line of conversation, I know that I've touched on this topic with you in the past, but you know, you go to the sales and certain stallions seem to, over the period of their, like they seem to throw better fillies or they throw better colts. And so, you know, you go to the sales and people want to have that stallion fillies, but not the males, and then other stallions vice versa. And, you know, the results do support that. So is there any sort of performance or sex linked performance from a genetic level for certain stallions? They're more likely to throw a better female or more likely to throw a better male?
So that's a really interesting question, and not something that we can answer immediately from the research that we have. But there definitely are mechanisms of inheritance that would enable those patterns to be seen. And this is, I suppose, getting into a little bit of technical details, but there's a mechanism known as imprinting. And what imprinting does is that it turns on or turns off genes depending on whether they've come from the maternal side or the paternal side. And it can also influence then what's going on in the different sexes of the offspring of these animals. So that's something that is not so straightforward to look at, but it can be, it could be examined. We do know that in other species that imprinting does have major effects on genes, particularly that are involved in growth and development. So if you consider that growth and development are important traits, and certainly important traits that can differentiate between colts and fillies, for example, then it's a very interesting hypothesis that you've just put forward there, Kat, that that would be really, really interesting to test in the context of this imprinting mechanism.
Well, I'm happy to be a research assistant, Emily.
Fantastic, you're hired.
It's incredible to talk to you. I feel like we could talk to you all day. It's you know, just seeing where the genetics is, you know, coming from sort of a human and sort of, you know, athletic sports science side of things, you know, knowing how genetics can play such a huge factor in the potential of an athlete, or how you, you know, train someone, and then just sort of see that now, you know, in the thoroughbreds, and, you know, there's so much more to learn. And I know that we've sort of touched on doing research to look at, you know, injuries, or whether the, you know, I've seen some of your research on the temperament and the willingness to want to train. And, you know, like, it's amazing how many areas genetics, you know, can play a huge role in it. It's not just, you know, the speed gene and that's it. It's sort of, and I know that you would be looking into all these different areas and, you know, just going through. So if anyone out there just wants to just have a little read, just look up Emmeline Hill, and just, like, it's incredible. But did you have any other questions, Josh, from your side of things?
You've just briefly touched on, obviously, you've done a lot of work in the cattle side of things. And is there anything that you'd like to see from what you've learned in terms of cattle genetics that you could see the thoroughbred industry sort of really lashing onto, and the way that they use them? Obviously, it's a very different output where you know, it's obviously the production with cattle, and, you know, we're breeding these thoroughbred athletes to run around a circle. But yeah, it's just if there's any sort of insights you've learned over the years that you've been interested.
Yeah, one of the, I suppose a parallel tool that we've developed for the thoroughbred that is well established within other livestock breeding systems is a breeding tool. So breeding tools to reduce inbreeding have been developed and are in place for all sorts of other livestock species to inform matings. And we've developed a platform that we call Checkmate. And Checkmate allows a mare owner to check or to perform a hypothetical mating against stallions on our platform to check for the level of inbreeding that is likely to occur in a foal from that mating. And by doing that, reducing inbreeding in that foal can improve the chances of that pregnancy being a success. In other words, completing to term, and also reducing inbreeding is likely to improve the chance of that foal being born healthy, with fewer issues and being sound enough to go on and race. This is not a new concept. This is something that is well established and firmly embedded within other breeding systems, and, you know, started out in the cattle industry and in other, as I said, in other livestock industries. So Checkmate is our platform. We have hundreds of stallions now that are on the platform that a mare owner can then match their mare against and make that prediction. And we have a lot of clients now in Australia that are already starting to use this, particularly considering the concerns that breeders have around pregnancy loss. That's a big thing, you know, because it appears that is not reducing over time, that the rates of pregnancy loss and also conception rates are not, it's not improving. Whereas you'd expect that it might improve with the, you know, all of the amazing veterinary and husbandry management practices that are in place. And if it's not improving with all of those things in place, then that maybe there's something else going on and we know that it's genetics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so important. And I think that's a real knowledge gap. I actually spoke to a few different smaller breeders at Melbourne Premier Sale, and, you know, they were not aware of Checkmate. So I think it's really important to sort of get that information out there. And anyone that's listening, so where can they go and, you know, find more information about Checkmate and any other, learn anything else that you think is important?
Yeah, so our website is equinomelabs.com. A lot of the information about our tests is on there, and contact details for myself and also for our Australian executive Fiona Gore is also on there, and they can contact us at any time if anybody has any questions or would like to inquire about genetic tests. So that's equinomelabs.com.
Thank you, Emmeline, for your time, and we'll be sure to put that website down on the podcast so people can get a direct link there. But thank you so much for your time and insights. It's such a fascinating world, and we're obviously always trying to learn more ourselves, and hopefully everyone's been able to take something away from it, whether you are a breeder, an owner, or a trainer.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you, Josh, for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emmeline.